I'm Joanna Shanks.
I'm Emma Taylor.
And this is Murder, She Spoke.
All right, guys, this week we have a very special episode for you. We actually have an advocate and Queen's Counsel with us tonight who's going to be having a bit of a chat with us about Scots law and some of the questions that we've got around it. As you know, we are not experts, so we thought we would bring one in. So this is Thomas Ross. Welcome to the podcast, Thomas.
Good evening. How are you?
Very, very well. It's fab to have you here with us. So why don't you give us a little bit of your background?
Yeah, well, I was at did law at Strathclyde University in Glasgow between about 1980-1984. Went straight into a legal aid practice in the Govan area of Glasgow, where, as it happened, some of my family came from. And I stayed there working mainly in the field of criminal defence, and mainly in Glasgow Sheriff Court, Glasgow District Court, sometimes neighbouring jurisdictions. And then in 1999, I left the solicitors firm that I worked at, and I was a partner there, and went to the Scottish Bar. So it takes about 9 months to qualify, so between the late 99 in the summer of 2000, I was doing the bar exams and the various requirements before you can become an advocate. I then qualified as an advocate in the summer of 2000 and have been busy ever since, I'm happy to say. And in 2017, I was lucky enough to be appointed one of Her Majesty's Counsel in Scotland. So since the summer of 2017, I have been entitled to use the term QC, which I only ever use when I'm at my work, and never as some of the English people do when they're trying to get a booking in a restaurant or an appointment with a doctor.
Can you tell us a little bit what being the Queen's Counsel means? And I understand you take the silk, is that correct term?
Aye, you're not far wrong. The reference to silk is the material from which your gown is made. So until you become a QC, you wear a gown which is not silk. Don't ask me to tell you what it is. I think it's some sort of, usually, it used to be wool, I think, but I think being polyester generally. And not until you become a QC are you entitled to wear a silk gown. So your clothing changes, the fancy dress changes a wee bit. You need to go out and spend a fortune on a silk gown. And if you're lucky, you get to wear it more or less every day and go to court. So that's the reference to taking silk or being in silk or something like that. It's to do with the quality of the gown that you wear.
Right. Do you wear one of those little curly wigs?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I do. And I was in a documentary, actually, which was screened almost a year ago, which was the first time they had televised an entire murder trial. And it was screened on BBC Scotland and also in BBC Two. And I had terrible trouble with the wig, and at one point it was sitting at a certain 45-degree angle to my head when I was cross-examining a witness. And oh, I can assure you that of all the work and effort I put into that trial, it is not only the first thing that everybody mentions, but the most popular comment that anybody has ever made in relation to that documentary was, what the hell was going on with your wig?
It's lucky you didn't become a meme in these days. Yeah. What was the name of the programme, just in case anyone's interested?
It's called Murder Trial. It's called Murder Trial, and it was on the BBC iPlayer for about a month. They won three BAFTAs actually in Scotland, and I dare say they will show it again fairly soon, given that they won the BAFTA.
Definitely. Oh, that sounds great. We'll need to keep an eye out for that then.
Yeah, I think we'll need to check that out.
Absolutely. So one of the reasons that we got in contact with yourself was that some of the cases that we cover obviously do go to court and have outcomes as a result of them. We cover them as lay people the best that we can, trying to pretty much stick word for word from the sources that we have so that we don't misrepresent anything. And something that's come up is the not proven verdict, which, as I understand, is unique to Scots law. Is that correct?
I believe it to be, yes.
So could you give us a more succinct understanding of what that actually means as a verdict?
Okay. It's probably necessary to go all the way back and explain how it came about, because as far as I know, Scotland is the only country which has three verdicts. And the paperwork in relation to it is a wee bit difficult to find, but it's commonly traced to a trial almost 300 years ago in 1728. And the accused in that trial was called Carnegie of Findhaven. He was a nobleman of some type, and he seems to have got absolutely slaughtered on a night out, and was very much under the influence of the bevy. And he ran his sword through the Earl of Strathmore, who was also bevied, and there was a third person present. And it seems to have been the case that they were all drunk. Certain insults were being thrown between them. And the Earl of Strathmore ended up dead at the point of Carnegie of Findhaven's sword. All of that seems to be pretty much agreed by everybody. At that time, there was a practice where the function of the jury was simply to hear the evidence and indicate whether the facts were proved or not proved. And in that case, I suppose, although I've never been able to find the recording, suppose the question for the jury might have been, has it been proved that Carnegie of Findhaven struck the Earl of Strathmore with his sword? It might have been as simple as that. And the jury would have been asked simply, has that allegation been proved or has it not been proved? If they said it had been proved, then the judge would have recorded a verdict of guilty and he would then have been sentenced to death. If they had said that the charge was not proved or that the facts were not proved, then he would have received a verdict of not guilty, as I understand it. So the whole thing was pretty simple back then. And what seems to have happened is that the jury did not want to convict Carnegie of Findhaven. They didn't want him to hang. And they seemed to think he probably had meant to assault the other person. Yeah, which actually in Scots law these days wouldn't matter, but somebody suggested that they thought he was trying to attack this third party and sort of accidentally struck the Earl of Strathmore. And so they didn't think he deserved to be convicted of murder, and the jury appreciated if they said that the facts had been proven, then the verdict would have been recorded as one of guilty and he would have hung. And therefore, they appear to have insisted on a verdict of not proven being recorded. So it's quite difficult because that's not the way that we go about things any longer. You know, the jury have not asked specific questions. Has this been proved? Has that been proved? They're simply asked to consider all the issues in the case and decide whether the verdict should be one of not proven or one of guilty or one of not guilty. And so that, I think, is part of the confusion, that it never, at that point, if it hadn't been for Carnegie or Findhaven, then things might have been a bit more straightforward. And it seems to have been a case of the jury digging their heels in. They were being told by the judge that they had to find in a particular way, and they didn't want to do that. and they insisted on a verdict of not proven with the result that he didn't hang. And thereafter, it seems that juries get back into the habit of the verdict of not proven. And so we went from a sort of binary situation for the jury where they could either favour an outcome where the accused was convicted or not convicted, to one where they had, which I suppose in a way is a sort of middle ground, but, you know, the charge hasn't been proved. And I think that's really key to all. But the problem is there's a terrible misunderstanding about what it means, and that's why it comes up so regularly as a discussion topic.
Yeah, I think from my point of view, as like I've said, as a layperson, previously I had been under the misconception that it was, we're pretty sure you did it, but we can't really prove it.
Yeah, I thought that too.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's just how I'd always taken it, but clearly that's not the case.
Well, in legal terms.
I mean, the fact is we don't know because we don't talk to jurors, you know, we don't talk to real life jurors. There was a study done by a couple of academics. It was a very good study, but it didn't involve real jurors in the sense of real cases with real consequences. You know, it was volunteers who sat as jurors watching pre-recorded trials, which lasted, I think, for about an hour or perhaps 2 hours maximum. And so it was a valuable exercise, but the people would know that nobody was going to prison, you know, that nobody's life was really going to be affected. And these are all issues that I would imagine play pretty heavily on the minds of real jurors. And I think it's probably a bit unfair to assume that every time there's a not proven, that the jury think, well, we believe that you did it, but it hasn't been proved. I think sometimes that will be the case. The classic case where it frequently is returned as a verdict is sexual crime. And it's pretty obvious to see why that is, you know, because very often the incident will have occurred when both parties have been under the influence of drink. That's quite a common feature, as you would imagine. And then they both come to court and they're both perfectly presentable. They both give a very coherent account of events. And really isn't any other evidence to, you know. So it becomes a bit of a sort of beauty contest where they're saying, well, I liked the female who's making the accusation, but I also quite like the male. And, you know, there isn't really any evidence that, you know, there's some evidence that she had sex with him, but he accepts that he had sex with her. So that doesn't take us anywhere. You know, where is the evidence that tells us whether it was consensual or non-consensual? Well, there really isn't any. You know, she says it's non-consensual, he says it's consensual. The not proven verdict is perfect. They're not saying we think you did it. They're saying, well, we don't know. We just can't really say.
Like a sort of he said, she said kind of situation where there's no, I guess, maybe in cases where there's no sort of hard evidence to support, and it does become a bit of a he said, she said situation, and that's maybe where a not proven verdict would maybe come out. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I've debated it with some of the advocates for rape victims, and understandably, when they see that there's a lot of not proven verdicts in sexual cases, they think there must be something wrong with the verdict.
Yeah.
But the reality is the acquittal rate in relation to sexual crime is round about the same both sides of the border. So, you know, there's more or less the same percentage of acquittals in England. And they don't have the not proven verdict in England. So, you know, there's not really a statistical argument to be made to suggest that people like jurors are quitting rape trials because they have the not proven option. You know, it looks as if, you know, they would, in England, they acquit even when they don't have the not proven verdict. So,
I would say from my point of view, if I was someone who had, you know, brought that case to court as a victim accusing someone, I think I would feel a slightly more comfortable having the not proven verdict as an outcome rather than not guilty. If I was still very much of the mindset that they, you know, they were guilty, they should be found guilty, but you could understand that perhaps the evidence wasn't enough to, you know, bring a jury to come to that. But if I was in that situation and they were found not guilty, I can see how that would be really upsetting for someone.
Yeah, I mean, I actually agree with that. That's my analysis of it. But the advocacy groups for victims of sexual crimes say the exact opposite. They say that people feel really let down by a not proven verdict because they feel as if the jury has not really done their job properly. They've just gone for the easy option. It's given the accused an extra chance of getting off. That's a sort of common argument. And I think until fairly recently, I took the view, well, if it's not broke, you know, why fix it? The justice system seems to me as an insider to be working relatively well. Usually the people who we expect to see convicted get convicted. The people who you expect to see acquitted generally get acquitted. There are obviously some unusual, unexpected things. However, I've become a bit persuaded that there is a stigma in society about the not proven verdict, and it may be that there is an argument for just clearing it up once and for all, because, you know, it would be very unfortunate if accused people were acquitted for perfectly good reasons and people were still talking about them, saying, well, they kind of did it, you know, everybody knows they did it.
Yeah, they're not saying, oh, well, he was found not guilty, so that's it, done and dusted. And I think that's the thing that confused me a little bit. I thought, well, actually, if you're accused of something and the verdict comes back as not proven, then that might be, if you're, especially if, say, for example, you weren't guilty, that might, for me, I thought, leave a bit of a question mark over your head, because people maybe wouldn't be convinced. Not that everyone would be convinced of your innocence if there was a not guilty verdict, but it made me think that you maybe still have a little bit of a question mark over your head if you received a not proven verdict.
Well, that was the thing that changed my mind, actually, was the research project, which I spoke to you about earlier. And for the first, although they were fake jurors, maybe been an unkind way to describe them, you know, they weren't real jurors, it did give the academics the chance to speak to them and see what they understood. And there was a real lack of understanding about the not proven verdict. Even though they're specifically told by the judge, you know, they have exactly the same effect. If it's not proven or not guilty, either way, that's an end of the prosecution. They can't bring another prosecution unless there's very special circumstances. Even then, the jurors would say things like, well, if it's not proven, they can have a retrial, you know, even when they were told that they couldn't. And one thing that I had never actually thought of, and it's recorded in the research paper, is at least one juror said, well, give him a not proven because he's on the sex offenders register anyway. He'll never get a job, you know, that's his life ruined. So we don't need to convict him. We don't need to give him a guilty. Gosh. Because if we give him a not proven, that's as good as a guilty, because who's going to employ him, you know? Which it could be more wrong, but, you know, if that's what people think about it, when they're actually told by a judge before they go away to think about it, what the rules are, you know, what must people who have never been in a jury think about it? You know, if that's the level of understanding of jurors. So, actually, there is a very simple... I'm not the only person who thinks this, but there is a very simple solution to it all. And it's to go back almost 300 years to where it all started. And the jury are simply told, as far as the facts of the case are concerned, are they proven or not proven? And then they report back to the judge. And if they say they're proven, then the judge finds you guilty. And if they say they're not proven, then the judge records that as a not guilty verdict. That's the easy answer to it, actually. But nobody really has. That's not very popular.
Is there any evidence that if there is a retrial that the accused having had a not proven verdict previously has any impact on how the jurors perceive the case?
There's never been a retrial because you can't have one, you know. So the minute you get a not proven verdict, that is an end of it. So there is a very restricted right to retry a case if there's fresh evidence or something like that.
Yeah.
But these have been high-profile cases where nobody would really remember what the verdict had been the first time round, but they would have read a lot about the case in the papers and maybe seen stuff about it. So that's a whole different dilemma that the accused has got. People will already have formed some sort of view because of the material which is available in the media. You know, most cases there's very little information to be found, actually. So
I actually wanted to ask you how you feel the sort of legal system or just the way that things happen in the criminal justice system in Scotland has changed since you started practicing. And I'm guessing the rise of social media and the internet being so prolific and everyone having access to the articles and the information, I'm sure that'll have had an effect throughout your career.
Well, we suspect that it has an effect, but the jury system can only really operate if we trust them, you know. So the judge tells the jury at the start of the trial, you cannot research the case on the internet, you cannot go on the internet and look for information. If somebody comes in, one of your fellow jurors comes in tomorrow and says, look, I have been looking on the internet and this guy did this before, you must tell us, you know, so that we can abandon the trial. And, you know, so that kind of thing is probably more frequent than we ever hear about, because it's entirely dependent on somebody, you know, informing on their fellow jurors, you know. And I suppose most people say, oh, we might just pretend we never heard that, you know. So, but it is a big problem because there is a clear public interest in the newspapers being able to publish information, and especially information in relation to court cases. And so the newspaper industry, the broadcasting industry, are very resistant to the idea that they should be banned from reporting things. So they do report things, and then we just have to trust the jurors not to look at it. I mean, I tried to get a judge to, I started a trial, a murder trial, about 5 years ago, and the accused had previously been convicted of attempted murder and was convinced that he couldn't get a fair trial because he just did not believe that nobody in the jury would search his name. You know, I can't remember his name, wouldn't tell you even if I could. But he'd quite an unusual name and thought, they just put my name in it and this case will come up. And then once they've heard that I stabbed somebody 5 years ago, what chance have I got? Mm-hmm. And it's quite instructive in the sense that I made the motion to the judge to try and get him to order the, I think it was the BBC, to take the report off. And he said he didn't have any power to do that. And so we continued with the trial. And the jury found him not proven. So there's two explanations for that. Either they followed the judge's directions and none of them searched the internet, none of them found out about the previous case, or more probably, some of them did search it, but then were able to overcome it and say, well, the fact that that happened 5 years ago doesn't mean he's guilty this time. And, you know, it was a self-defense case where he was sitting in a car and had been attacked by somebody, well, two people actually, both of whom had weapons. And one of the attackers ended up dead. And so it was a proper trial where the jury had two separate accounts of the way in which this thing had happened. And seems, as I say, either didn't know about his previous case or didn't know about it and said, well, we're still prepared to give you the benefit of the doubt, you know. So it's an issue, but, you know, all we can really do is tell the jury not to do it and trust them.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's been any other significant changes? Is there any landmark cases that you feel have maybe affected the way that the criminal cases are processed and held in Scotland now?
There's a real tension between the right, which everybody acknowledges, that witnesses should not be embarrassed by issues which have nothing to do with the case, and this arises mainly in relation to sexual offences and what sometimes are called the rape shield provisions. And Scotland were pretty late to bring in legislation about that, but there was an idea that when women came to give evidence in sex cases, they would be asked about previous boyfriends and previous relationships. Mm-hmm. It was very seldom ever permitted, in fact, but it was believed that this was what happened. So they brought in legislation, and increasingly the legislation has been tightened by the judges, and there is a genuine concern on the part of advocates and solicitors who appear for people accused of sexual offences, that has now got to the stage where things which are relevant to the case before the jury are prohibited. And that is really the biggest issue at the moment.
What sort of things can't you ask then?
Well, I mean, the worst case that I can think of, there was a short relationship between the accused and the complainer in which the accused had never had any sexual contact with the complainer, was preparing to go and stay with her or go for a night out with her or something, and they had been sort of texting each other, and the subject of her sort of sexual preferences come up in the text. He was then later accused of doing one of the things in respect of which she had expressed a preference for. And when he tried to read evidence of that, so he was saying, well, how can she say that that was non-consensual? She texted me during the day and said that this is what she likes to do. In fact, of all the things that she likes to do, this is the thing she likes to do most. Mm-hmm. And the Scottish judges held that he wasn't allowed to raise that in the trial. So the trial took place. The jury had no knowledge of the text messages which had been exchanged. Now, I don't think that's fair. I don't see how the accused can get a fair trial in that situation. But the way the rules have been written and interpreted by the Scottish courts, they say that is not the issue. You know, the issue is whether she consented at the time when the act took place.
Yeah.
And I agree with that.
You can argue that regardless of her preferences, that doesn't mean she's consenting to that at that given point, isn't it? So that's obviously what they're trying to prevent.
He wouldn't have been able, you know, the intention was not to argue that she had given consent in the afternoon. The intention of the defence was to argue she gave consent at the time when it happened, and support for his position is given for the fact that she'd expressed a preference for that when they'd been texting each other. So he was allowed to go in and say, well, she consented to it at 10 o'clock, but he wasn't allowed to say, and at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, she sent me a text saying she was looking forward to it.
Yeah.
You know.
I think that's one of the things that we've come across when we've been covering cases and there's been information that's not, or it's perhaps been withheld, you know, or not allowed to be presented. And I think that's one of the things for me, or actually Emma and I, we've both had this discussion about context. Because, you know, for me, I'm definitely sort of like a see the whole picture kind of person. And sometimes I feel that with the, some of the cases that are seen in court, it's just seen through a very small snapshot. And you think, well, if there's a greater context around that, would it alter the, you know, the understanding of the jury or the verdict that they come to? That's something that I've certainly wondered in some of the cases that we've covered.
Yeah, was there not, there's, I'm not going to get it right, so you'll need to tell me what it is. Is there not a certain condition under Scots law where they can bring in evidence from a previous case if, for example, the circumstances are very, very similar or and it's in a short, you know, a close period of time?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And we call it, the lawyers call it the Muroff Doctrine. But that was really just the first person who was convicted and whose name appears in the books. And the idea is, well, the Alex Salmond case was a good example of it, you know, because I think there were about 10 women who had made the allegations. So the Crown case was, on each of these 10 occasions, nobody else was present other than the person who made the allegation. But because they all speak of the same sort of conduct, if you believe witness X, then she gives support to witness Y because they both say it happened at the same place in the same sort of circumstances. So it would be the same case, you know. So although the only slight, you got it absolutely spot on. The only thing, I suppose, which was slightly off was you spoke about previous cases. I know exactly what you meant by saying that, but they would all be tried at exactly the same time. So you quite commonly, it happens, you know, in families, sometimes where there's been sexual abuse, the family just decides, we're not going to go to the authorities about this. You know, it's happened, it was my sister or, you know, my cousin or something, and we've all moved on with our lives and we're not going to do anything about it because, you know, we've put it all behind us and why break up the family and he has to go to prison and all that. Not an uncommon position for a family to take. And then the accused starts on the granddaughter or something. You know, they hear a rumour, oh God, you know, there's a rumour that he's been, you know, interfering with the granddaughter. And then the family from 10 years ago say, right, well, that's it. You know, we were going to let him off. But if he's going to put other kids in danger, we can't live with that any longer. So we're going to go along. So you've got this sort of odd trial where the jury are sitting here and they hear evidence from his sister in relation to things that happened in 1985, you know, when they were all kids. And then they hear, you know, evidence from an 8-year-old about things that happened in, you know, year 2001. And, you know, when he was the granddad or the stepdad or something, you know. Right. So it's not an uncommon situation, but it would be the same jury hearing the whole story, yeah. And then the Crown would say, well, look, this is just what he does, you know. So these are instances of a common course of sort of criminal conduct, and, you know, more or less the same thing that he does with all these wee girls, and therefore you can conclude that they're all telling the truth. So that's legitimate, and there isn't really any more use of that now, although I think more people are coming forward now for a variety of different reasons, you know. So there are more of these cases, but there's no real big difference in the rules from when I started, which was, you know, the question really. The big change has been in the lens to which the judges are going to restrict the questions that we can ask, you know, that the areas that we can explore, to say to the jury, well, how can you be so certain that he's telling lies when he said to the police at the time, she sent me text that afternoon saying that of all the things that she liked to do, this was her favourite. Mm-hmm. And the police went and got her phone and checked, and sure enough, he was telling the truth that she had sent those texts. We don't get a chance to do that because the judges say, no, that's collateral, that's the word that's used, that's not the issue for the jury. And, you know, I'm not the only person that thinks that's unfair.
Yeah. So then it's fair to say if a person had been actually tried for a similar crime at a different time, that's when it can't be brought in, typically, if they've been charged with some a similar offence at a later time.
That's where it gets really, really complicated because a few years ago, I would have said to you, you're right, once you've been found not guilty, then nobody will ever hear anything about it again. There's been two developments. The first is the one I referred to earlier, where in very unusual circumstances, the Crown can get authority for a fresh prosecution, which just wasn't possible 10 years ago. And it's only happened twice, I think, and it's still very, very unusual. The other thing, which is really technical, is that a separate concept has developed where, in addition to the charges which are brought against the accused, the Crown can use what's called a docket. And the docket, it looks like a charge, but the purpose of it is to allow them to bring in evidence of other things. And let me give you an example of that. There was a case a couple of years ago where the accused had raped his wife, I think it was his wife, and at the time when it happened, there was no evidence other than her evidence, which was not going to be enough. So no other victims came forward, nobody else said that he'd done anything to them. She didn't report it at the time, I think, so there was no forensic or any medical or evidence like that. So they took a statement from her and then said, well, we can't go forward with this because there's no other evidence. They separated. He moved to England and she discovered that he had been convicted in England of raping a female. So I'm not sure who found out about this first, but when they did, they then brought him back to Scotland and they tried him and there was one charge, namely raping his wife, but the Crown were allowed to lead evidence of what had happened in England. And the jury would never be asked to bring a verdict in relation to what happened in England, but they could hear from the victim of the English case. And then the Crown, the prosecution, could go to the jury and say, well, look, he's done this twice. You know, he did it with his wife in Scotland, and then he did it with this woman in England. And therefore, you know, he can be convicted in relation to the Scottish case. So it can happen. And it's also been held that even when you're found not guilty in relation to a previous case, the same thing can happen. And the logic of it is, well, you're not been retried for the thing you've been found not guilty of, because you're still not guilty of that. But the jury can hear about it so they can consider it in relation to any new allegations. So I hope it's hard for us to get our head around it sometimes, even when you're working with it. So it is true to say you won't be convicted of something that you've previously been acquitted of, but it might come up and you might have to sit in court. Actually, there was quite an interesting case recently where they did exactly that, and the accused had pled guilty to a case, and then they used that case where he pled guilty to try and prove old allegations which had happened in Scotland. And the reason we found out about it was that the solicitor, it was a sheriff court case, so there were no advocates involved, and the solicitor had said to the jury, well, you might wonder why I didn't cross-examine that woman when she came in and gave evidence. Well, I didn't want to waste your time, ladies and gentlemen. You know, I know you're all busy and you've got busy lives and
Oh,
you're not going to be asked any to give a verdict. If you're not going to be asked to give a verdict, I didn't want to waste your time. And of course, everybody who knows is like, the reason you didn't cross-examine her is because the accused had pled guilty to that charge at the time when it came up, you know. So you didn't have any basis for suggesting anything to her other than that he'd done it. And unwisely, he was convicted. And unwisely, they then appealed the conviction, saying that the Crown had said things in the course of the trial which they shouldn't have said, which was putting your chin out if ever I saw it, because the appeal court then get the chance to say, not only did the Crown not do anything that was illegitimate, You went to the jury and tried to argue that you didn't cross-examine the jury, you know, because you're a benevolent gentleman who didn't want to waste their time, when the reality was you'd nothing to cross-examine them on, because your accused not only was obviously guilty, but had himself accepted that he was guilty. So,
yeah,
you know, so that you know, it's developing all the time, and I don't make any criticism of them. It's a very vocal, active advocacy support group that victims of sexual offences have in Scotland, and I know one of the people involved quite well, and it's definitely having an impact, you know, constantly saying it's a low conviction rate in relation to sexual offences is constantly having an effect in the way in which these sort of issues are dealt with. And, you know, so in other words, what I'm saying is, how have things changed? Well, in 2000, when I started at the bar, you wouldn't have had witnesses coming in to speak to accusations where the accused had been found not guilty. You wouldn't have them coming in to speak to accusations where they'd been found guilty, for that matter. You would only be hearing from the victim in relation to that case. And you would be able to ask her, did you send them a text that afternoon saying you were looking forward to whatever it was she preferred? Whereas in 2021, you don't get the chance to ask that question.
Yeah, fair enough.
What do you think would need to further change to affect the conviction rates? Do you think that there is anything that can be done, or do you think that we're at a level where we're doing as much as we can, and until there is more concrete evidence for some of these cases, you're just going to end up with a not proven verdict for them?
I think it's quite a specialised area of work, and I think the advocacy groups did have a realistic argument when very inexperienced prosecutors were conducting rape trials. Because most things in life that are worth knowing are learned through experience, and you're undoubtedly a better lawyer when you've been in the game for 20 years than you were when you started, you know. So it was a perfectly valid argument that if the prosecution were not set up to create specialist prosecutors, then that might affect the conviction rate. And so they took that on board, and they now have a sexual crimes unit, had for a number of years, and it's a terrible, terribly hard shift, where people go in and do it for 3 years or 4 years, and that's all they're doing. You know, they don't get to do a murder case or an attempted murder case or a robbery. They're just doing these cases, which often involve young children and always involve people who are upset. You know, it's a real, real tough shift. So they don't have that complaint any longer. The people who are prosecuting rape cases are generally very, very experienced at doing it. So I'm happy with that. I've always said that the conviction rate should exactly match the number of cases that are proved beyond reasonable doubt. And I'm happy that it does that. I don't want innocent people convicted, you know. So if people are out there saying the conviction rate's 20%, it should be 25%. That seems to me that they want 5% of innocent people convicted. You know, I don't want that. You know, it might be 25% 1 year and 95% the next year. As long as it matches the number of people who had a case proved against them, I'm happy with that, you know.
It's just a fascinating field to be in. What attracted you to law as a profession in the first place?
It's quite a hard question to answer, but I was very keen on it very, very young. And it sounds absolutely mad, but I think there's evidence I wanted to do it even before I left primary school. Somebody quite close to me got the jail. Somebody in the family was imprisoned for a breach of the peace type thing, nothing particularly serious, when I was 8. And there was a real kind of sense of unfairness about it, because he had undoubtedly been given as good as he was getting. He got involved in a fight with the police, and he ended up with 7 broken ribs, and as a first offender, was sent to prison for 60 days, you know. And that must have affected me, you know, at the age of 8. I don't really have any recollection of saying, right, that's it, I'm going to become a lawyer, you know. But it does seem unusual that by the age of 11 or 12 or something, that you were telling people that you were going to become a lawyer, you know. So I never had any notion of doing anything other than that, and was completely committed to it, and always have been.
It's a long slog. It's a lot of studying, and it's a long progression for people to go through. Yeah. I know that there are actually some high school teachers that listen to this and the podcast and share it with their students. So I don't know if maybe you've got any guidance or tips for anyone that's thinking about going into the legal profession.
I mean, the first thing I would say is it's not as hard as all the lawyers make out, you know.
Right.
Absolutely not. I mean, the hardest thing by a million miles is getting in. I mean, every year there are more people who want to be lawyers than the university has places for. So that's the first thing. It's basically reading a lot of information, remembering it and writing it down. So if you can do that, you can do the law degree standing in your head. Honestly, it's not difficult. Lawyers try to pretend that it's really, really hard. You know, compared to some other disciplines, it's not hard. I've got to say, back when I did it, it really was simply remembering things and writing it down. I know nowadays it's much more interactive and there's much more expected of the students in terms of advocacy, for example. We didn't do any advocacy at all. Nowadays, they're encouraged to present arguments and all of that. And at that stage, they should remember that everybody was hopeless when they first did it, you know. Everybody, you know. And therefore, do your best. Try and watch other people. Get to court. You know, that is by far the best thing. I mean, the High Court, you know, there are a dozen people who have been doing it their entire life, and you can go and watch them for nothing.
Yeah, get to court to watch them, not as part of a trial, hopefully.
Not at the moment, you know. It's not pretty moment, tough no. at the moment. But, you know, I do murder trials, and there's room for 50 people in the public benches, and there's one guy that's come in because he's been thrown out of the hostel and it's raining, you know. I mean, nobody turns up. And you've got people with 30 years experience who are standing up presenting arguments to juries, and there's nobody there to watch them.
That's really surprising that, you know, say sort of students of law wouldn't sort of jump on that opportunity to, you know, be a spectator in court, especially where it doesn't cost anything, where they can have access to, is it the public gallery, and they wouldn't sort of...
But to be fair to the students, it's pretty daunting, you know. I mean, if you don't really know anybody, just to walk into the High Court building and say, right, I'm here, I'm a student, you know, I want to go and see a trial. I mean, I have students helping me with things, and I always encourage them to come and to bring their pals and all of that. But if you don't have any contacts and nobody's really pushing you to do it, and you've got essays to write and, you know, exams to prepare for and all that, you know, but I'm sending out the message, you know, nobody's going to be unwelcoming. Anybody in the High Court will be of assistance. And, you know, you'll learn more sitting, and if you go on the right day, you can learn more in a day than you would learn in an entire term or trying to teach advocacy, you know.
Wow. I think we're missing a bit of a trick. I think we have plans for the next time I come up to Scotland.
I was going to say that's our next day out, Joanna.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we should go up and hang around the High Court and see if we can get on the get in the public gallery for a murder trial. I'm up for that, Emma,
You should, you know. And it was one of the court and the prosecution were really happy about the documentary for that reason, you know, that a lot of people said, well, I didn't know that's what happened in the trial. And what I always say to the students, when I went back to Strathclyde University and spoke to them about it in the school, you know, you saw about 1/100th of the trial, you know. You saw 2 minutes of a speech, or you saw a minute and a half of a cross-examination.
Did you get annoyed if they cut out the really good bits of your speech?
Well,
I would. I would get really annoyed. I'd be like, oh, they missed that really snappy bit I got at the end.
I fought really hard not to get annoyed about anything, you know. but it is difficult. And obviously there were a few people commented on it. And one of the things that I actually remember is the speech lasted for an hour and 20 minutes. And they showed about a minute or 2 minutes of it in the documentary. And I was in the pub having a pint on a Saturday night. And this guy, who I knew a wee bit, came up and said, oh, I loved that documentary. You know, that was fantastic. You know, brilliant. And his wife was kind of standing and she's just looked up and I said, oh, how you doing? And she said, didn't you like your speech? Well, you only heard a minute and a half of it, you know?
Yeah.
And she said, well, I never really understood what you were getting at. I said, well, because you only heard a minute and a half, you know, of a speech that lasted about 90
minutes.
Yeah, I was going to say that, like, you know, it's when you were talking earlier about the documentary and your wig was squinting and how you took flack for that, and you think, you know, forget all the hard work that you've put into, you know, all like the years of learning and all, you know, all the effort you've put in and all the homework and all the rest of it. It's just,
no, your wig was squinting.
That's that, really. Like, that's what it's saying.
Thanks for the constructive feedback. That's great.
Are there any more documentaries in the pipeline? Anything similar?
They'd love to do it, but it's incredibly expensive to do it.
Mm.
You know, that trial lasted about, I think, 8-9 weeks, and they recorded every second of it. And they could only do it with remote cameras, which apparently cost a fortune. So they had to hire, I think, 8 remote cameras. And then set up a rig outside the courtroom to control the cameras.
Yeah.
And then the editing exercise was just about the biggest anybody had ever seen, you know. So they had 8 weeks worth of footage and they had to get it down to 60 minutes. So
wow,
it was
that's
a
big
massive,
ask.
Massive endeavor.
You never know the BAFTA money. Do they not? Maybe they might get a little boost in money.
I don't think you get any money for it. I think they just give you a wee trophy or something, you know.
I would be asking for a trophy. I'd be like, come on, guys.
I must say, in fairness, they promised to take me to the night out, the BAFTA night out, and we did it remotely on Zoom. And they won three awards and they won 2 of them.
Did you set up a red carpet in your house?
I was trying to do that. And they also sent me a bottle of malt whiskey to drink while watching it. But sadly, I then had a trial the day after it, so the malt whiskey still in the gift
bag. Enjoy it.
Did you get your wife to present the whiskey to you like a presentation, like an award?
No, I never even get a new suit out of it. It's a disaster.
Oh, nightmare.
But they'll win more BAFTAs. They're brilliant people. So the next time they win a BAFTA and the pubs are open, I'll be in a taxi and text them to see where they are. Don't worry about it.
Yeah,
definitely. I was going to say, you can't really get chucked out your own house for misbehaving or anything. So
yeah.
Might have been for the best.
Listen, you've not met Mrs. Ross.
Definitely.
Thomas, thank you so much for chatting with us. We've probably gone over everything that we can possibly think to ask you. If we have any more questions, we will try and grab you another time for another chat. For all of our listeners, where do they find you if they want to find you?
Well, they can get me on our stable website. We're known as Benchmark Advocates, and you can get us on benchmarkadvocates.co.uk, and I also put quite a lot of information relating to Benchmark Advocates on Twitter. We have our own Twitter page, and I'm also on Twitter as @GlasgowAdvocate, and sometimes I forget what one I'm on and put information in relation to both. So if you go to any of those, you should be able to get me. I'm absolutely delighted to take any questions from any students at any time. So if you can track me down, don't be shy. Get in touch and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight. So You have been listening to Murder, She Spoke. If you have enjoyed the episode, please leave us a rating and or review. You can also find us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. Thanks very much. We'll see you next week.